All right, so welcome back to the deep dive, everybody. Today we are going to be taking a pretty fascinating look at, well, a le legal puzzle, I guess you could call it. It's this case, Henry v. Milwaukee County. Now, at first glance, this might just seem like your run-of-the-mill court case, but it actually offers some pretty compelling insights into how anti-discrimination law and specifically Title VII, how it plays out in these unexpected places. And in this particular case, it's about the staffing policies at a juvenile detention center. And, you know, for those of you out there really interested in employment law, equal opportunity, or, you know, even just kind of the limitations of employer defenses, this case really provides some valuable stuff to think about.
I think that's right. It's a case that, a lot of people might not be familiar with, but when you really start getting into it, there are some really interesting things that you learn about employment law. And like you said, about what employers can and can't do, and particularly with respect to Title VII.
Right. And, you know, at the heart of this case is a policy that, you know, on its face, it kind of seems neutral. It's a same-sex staffing policy in the housing units at this detention center. But what we're going to find out is that this policy had a huge disproportionate impact on the female juvenile corrections officers, you know, often called JCOs. So, you know, essentially, it's this legal battle over whether or not this policy is really just a form of sex discrimination or whether it can be considered a legitimate job requirement.
You know, one of the things that makes this case so interesting is that it really highlights the tension that can arise between, wanting to protect the privacy and safety of individuals in a setting like a juvenile detention center and ensuring that you're complying with anti-discrimination laws.
So let's kind of start at the beginning here. You know, Milwaukee County, they put this policy in place way back in 1997. Can you tell us a little bit about the reasoning, the thinking behind requiring a male officer in the male housing units and then a female officer in the female units at all times?
So, I mean, the county at the time, their stated reason was really about safety, security, and privacy, right? They wanted to ensure the privacy of the detainees. And, that makes a lot of sense, particularly when you're thinking about things like showering, using the restroom, those sorts of things. And they probably also argued that this policy would contribute to creating a safer and more secure environment, both for the staff and for the detainees themselves. And you can imagine that, there could be situations where having a same-sex officer present might help to de-escalate a situation or prevent any kind of, inappropriate behavior. And potentially, they might have even argued that, this policy could contribute to a more effective rehabilitation environment, that, having a same-sex officer as a role model could be beneficial for the detainees.
I mean, when you just hear it initially, it sounds like a, pretty reasonable kind of precaution, you know.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that, right? Because I think we can all understand that there are legitimate concerns about privacy and safety in a setting like this. And I think it's natural for, a detention center to want to take steps to address those concerns. But the question here, as with many things in the law, is, where do you draw the line? And when does a policy, even if it's well-intentioned, when does it cross the line into discrimination?
So, you know, I can see the logic there. But for the female JCOs, how did this rule, that seems pretty sensible on its face, how did it actually become a problem for them?
Well, the issue really came down to the numbers, right? So there were a lot more male detainees than female detainees at the facility. And, because the policy required a male officer on duty in every male unit and a female officer in every female unit, it meant that there was simply a much higher demand for male JCOs, right? There were more male units that needed to be staffed. And so what ended up happening is that the male JCOs had access to a lot more shifts than the female JCOs did.
So the policy doesn't explicitly say we're going to give fewer hours to women, but in practice, that's what it was doing.
That's exactly right. And it's a really good example of what we call disparate impact. So a policy can be facially neutral, meaning it doesn't explicitly discriminate against a particular group, but if it has a disproportionate impact on one group over another, then it can still be considered discriminatory under the law. And in this case, it wasn't just about the total number of shifts. The overnight shifts, which often come with, higher pay, more overtime opportunities, those became a real point of contention. Because there were more male units needing overnight coverage, the female JCOs were often kind of locked out of those more desirable assignments.
So just to be super clear for everyone listening, the takeaway here is that a policy, even if it looks gender neutral, on paper at least, it can still lead to discriminatory outcomes in practice. especially when the underlying circumstances, like in this case, the detainee population, aren't really equal to begin with. So enter Ursel Henry and Terry Lewis. They're the female JCOs who really stepped in to say, hey, this is sex discrimination. And they're pointing to Title VII. Can you kind of walk us through their argument there?
Sure. So Henry and Lewis, they were basically arguing that while the policy itself didn't explicitly say we're treating women differently, the effect of the policy was discriminatory.
Right.
It was denying them equal terms and conditions of employment just because of their sex.
Okay.
They weren't getting the same access to shifts, the same opportunities for overtime and higher pay. And so they filed this lawsuit alleging a violation of Title VII, which, you know, is a federal law that prohibits discrimination in employment based on a number of protected characteristics, including sex.
Right. Okay. Now, how did Milwaukee County try to defend this policy in court? What was their main line of defense against these allegations?
The county's primary argument was that the same-sex staffing policy was what we call a bona fide occupational qualification, or a BFOQ.
Right, the BFOQ.
Now, this is a very specific and narrow exception to Title VII.
Right. It's something you hear a lot about in employment law, but it seems like it's really, really hard for employers to actually use it successfully.
That's right. It's a very high bar.
Okay.
And, you know, essentially, it allows employers to discriminate based on sex, religion, or national origin if they can prove that that discrimination is absolutely essential to the normal operation of their business. So the courts have consistently said that this is an extremely limited exception, and the employer has the burden of proof to really demonstrate that it applies.
Okay.
And generally, to successfully claim a BFOQ, they have to meet a two-part test. First, they have to show that the qualification, in this case being a particular sex, is reasonably necessary to the essence of their business. So, like you said, it's not just that they think it's a good idea or that it's common practice. They have to show that it's fundamental to what they do.
Okay, so what they do, like the very core of how they do it.
Exactly. And then second, they have to show that there's a factual basis to believe that all or substantially all members of the excluded sex would be unable to perform the job safely and effectively, or that it would be impossible or highly impractical to make individualized assessments.
So essentially, in this case, Milwaukee County had to show that having only male officers supervise male detainees overnight and only female officers supervise female detainees, that was absolutely essential, fundamental to running a juvenile detention center, right?
That's right. They had to convince the court that it was absolutely necessary for safety, privacy, and for effective rehabilitation.
Yeah.
And, you know, they probably argued, as we discussed earlier, that this was necessary to protect the privacy of the detainees, to ensure the safety and security of both the staff and the detainees, and potentially to create that, you know, positive rehabilitative environment.
Right. Right. I mean, those are all arguments that, you know, I can see how they would make those arguments. But ultimately, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, they disagreed with the lower court and they sided with the female JCOs. Why? What was the reasoning there?
Yeah, so the Seventh Circuit, they were really focused on whether or not the county had actually met that really high burden of proof for the BFOQ defense.
Okay.
And there were several key factors in their decision. One was that Milwaukee County simply didn't provide enough evidence to show that this very strict same-sex staffing policy was truly reasonably necessary to the core function of the detention center, especially during those overnight hours when, you know, the detainees were generally locked in their rooms.
Right, right. I remember that reasonably necessary part of the BFOQ. So it sounds like the court is saying, show us how this detention center just wouldn't be able to function, wouldn't be able to achieve its fundamental purpose without this rule.
Exactly. They needed to demonstrate that it was essential, not just preferable. And another really crucial fact that the court pointed out was that for years before this 1997 policy was put in place, female JCOs had worked overnight shifts in the male housing units.
Oh, wow.
And there was no evidence of any widespread problems. Like, they didn't have a history of safety issues, privacy violations, or anything to suggest that it was really negatively impacting rehabilitation.
So they're saying, well, if it worked before without the rule, how can you say that this is absolutely essential now?
Exactly. It just undermines the whole argument that this policy was truly necessary.
Right. Right. That's a really powerful point. I mean, if the facility operated just fine without this rule for years, it seems a lot harder to argue that it suddenly became a must-have.
Right. And it wasn't just about the lack of evidence to support the necessity of the policy. The Seventh Circuit also took issue with the fact that Milwaukee County hadn't really explored or implemented any less discriminatory alternatives. So they didn't show that they had considered things like, I don't know, installing privacy curtains in the rooms or implementing some kind of staggered monitoring schedules or even just providing additional training to address any concerns that they had.
So they're not just saying, you know, we think this is the best way to handle things. They actually have to show that they've thought about other options, other ways to achieve the same goals.
Exactly. It's not enough to just say, well, we think this is the best way. You have to show that you've considered other possibilities and that those possibilities wouldn't work.
Right, right. This is such a crucial point for anyone listening, you know, especially if you're thinking about a career in employment law. If you're going to claim this BFOQ defense, you have to show that you've really exhausted other options.
Exactly. You can't just rely on assumptions or general concerns. You need to have concrete evidence, like why this policy is truly necessary and why less discriminatory options just wouldn't be feasible. The court was basically saying, show us the data. Show us why this policy is the only way to achieve your goals of safety, privacy, and rehabilitation.
Right. Not just intuition or tradition. Data.
Exactly. Data over intuition.
Yeah.
And I think Chief Judge Easterbrook, in his concurring opinion, he really emphasized that point. I mean, he was pretty direct in his criticism of the county. He basically said that they were relying on stereotypes and folk wisdom rather than actual objective evidence.
Yeah.
He was basically saying that you can't just justify a discriminatory practice based on, you know, intuition, gut feelings, or what you've always done. You need data. You need facts.
Yeah, it's a really clear message. And I remember that quote, intuition and folk wisdom don't cut it. Data does.
Yeah, I mean, that really sums it up, doesn't it?
It really does. So beyond just the BFOQ defense, the court also had to look at whether Henry and Lewis had initially presented enough evidence to even suggest that discrimination had occurred. Right.
Right. They had to establish what we call a prima facie case.
Right. And for our listeners who may not be legal experts, can you break down what that means, that prima facie case, and what they had to show to establish that?
Sure. So in discrimination cases, we often use what's called the McDonnell-Douglas framework.
Okay.
And it's essentially a burden-shifting framework. Mm. So to establish a prima facie case of sex discrimination, the plaintiffs, in this case, Henry and Lewis, generally have to show four things. Mm-hmm. First, they have to show that they are members of a protected class. So in this case, being women.
Okay.
Second, they have to show that they were qualified for their jobs and that they were performing them satisfactorily.
Okay.
Third, they have to show that they suffered some kind of adverse employment action. So something like being demoted, being fired, having their hours reduced, or like in this case, not being able to access those higher paying overnight shifts.
Okay.
And then fourth, they have to show that similarly situated employees who are not members of that protected class, so in this case, male JCOs, were treated more favorably. So it's kind of setting up this initial, you know, set of facts that suggest that discrimination might have occurred. And if they can establish those four things, then the burden shifts to the employer to provide a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for their actions.
Okay. So in this case, did the Seventh Circuit agree that those four things had been shown?
Yes. They found that Henry and Lewis had in fact established a prima facie case.
Okay.
They were women, they were qualified for their jobs, they were performing their jobs adequately, and they suffered an adverse employment action because they were not getting the same access to shifts and the same opportunities for overtime and higher pay as their male colleagues. And the fact that similarly situated male JCOs who could work in those more numerous male units didn't face the same limitations, that was enough to establish that initial case of discrimination.
Okay. So then it shifts back over to the county to say, okay, well, here's the reason why, which we've already discussed, that BFOQ argument. But the court says that's not good enough.
Right. So they basically said, yes, it looks like discrimination happened here. Mm-hmm. Now, Milwaukee County, you need to give us a really, really good reason for this policy. And as we've talked about, they just weren't able to do that.
Right.
They couldn't meet that high bar of the BFOQ defense. Mm. Now, there was one other aspect of this case that I think is worth mentioning, and that's the retaliation claims.
Oh, right, right.
So Henry and Lewis had previously filed some unrelated EEOC complaints.
Okay.
And they argued that after this same-sex staffing policy was implemented, they started facing some negative treatment from the county. Things like being denied training opportunities, being given less desirable assignments.
Oh, okay.
And so they filed additional grievances alleging retaliation. Hmm. They were essentially saying, we're being punished for speaking out against discrimination.
Right, right. I mean, that's a protected activity. You can't punish someone for filing a complaint.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the district court had initially dismissed these retaliation claims.
Oh.
But the Seventh Circuit disagreed. And they sent that part of the case back down to the lower court for further consideration.
Okay.
They said the lower court needed to take a closer look at whether the county had taken these negative actions against Henry and Lewis because they had engaged in this protected activity of filing those discrimination complaints.
So kind of a mixed bag for Henry and Lewis at that initial trial, but they get a pretty big win on appeal for that core discrimination claim. And then they have another shot at arguing the retaliation claims.
Exactly. And it really shows how important it is to appeal these cases when you believe that the lower court got it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we wrap up here, what are some of the key takeaways from this case? You know, what's the significance of Henry v. Milwaukee County, especially for, you know, our listeners who are law students, you know, thinking about a career in employment law?
Yeah.
What should they be paying attention to here?
I think there are a few really key things to highlight. First, this case really underscores just how narrowly the courts interpret the BFOQ defense. It's not about what the employer thinks is a good idea, or even what's common practice in their industry. It has to be a real, genuine necessity. It has to be essential to the very core of their business.
Right. You can't just rely on stereotypes or assumptions.
Exactly. And second, this case highlights the importance of looking beyond just the surface of a policy.
Right. Right.
You know, a policy might seem neutral on its face, but you have to look at its actual impact. You have to ask, is it creating a disparate impact? Is it disproportionately harming one group over another?
Right. Right.
And if it is, then you have to scrutinize the employer's justification for that policy very carefully. And finally, I think this case really emphasizes the importance of data and evidence.
Data.
Data.
Yeah.
You know, Easterbrook's quote, "Intuition and folk wisdom don't cut it, data does." That really sums it up. Employers can't just rely on hunches or gut feelings. They need hard evidence to justify any policy that has a discriminatory impact.
Right. So for anyone listening, especially if you're studying law, remember, when you're analyzing these employment discrimination cases, you have to look at the details. You have to really think critically about the employer's justifications, especially if they're claiming a BFOQ. You know, ask those tough questions. What's the evidence?
Mm-hmm.
Have they considered less discriminatory alternatives? Is this really a necessity? Or is it just based on assumptions?
Exactly. And I think Henry v. Milwaukee County is just a great example of that. It really illustrates those core principles. And I think it also raises some broader questions that are still relevant today. You know, questions about privacy, safety, and equal opportunity in the workplace, mm-hmm. and how we balance those competing interests.
Right, right. So as you're thinking about a career in law, as you're thinking about these issues, remember Henry v. Milwaukee County. Think about how it might apply in different contexts.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this has been another fascinating deep dive. You know, thanks to everyone for listening in. And we will see you all next time.